Okay, on behalf of Rabbi and Mrs. Kalman and myself, we're once again really pleased to welcome you to another Torah in Motion program. I'm going to leave it to others to introduce Professor Sperber. I just want to take a couple of minutes to talk about upcoming programming. Specifically, 2 weeks this Sunday on November 7th, we're running our third annual Renewing Our Spirit Conference, and this year's conference is very exciting. There's brochures at the door, but just briefly to tell you, we're going to have Rabbi Norman Lamb, Rabbi Nathan Lopez Cardozo, Rabbi Michael Broyd, Rabbi Yosef Reinman, Ms. Bracha Ratner from Toronto, Rabbi Michael Skoback, and from London, Rabbi Penny Dunner. Since we started Torah in Motion, our goal has always been to try and address issues of spiritual, sociological, halachic significance, to try and be honest about them, to try and probe them as deeply as possible. This year's conference will be no different. The kinds of topics we'll be looking at, we hope, are of great significance and relevance. We'll be looking at issues pertaining to the future of Judaism. There'll be a five-way panel down here in this room that I'll be moderating with Rabbis Lamb, Cardozo, and Reinman, as well as a number of other topics relating to women in Judaism, halachic change, and the status of non-Jewish movements in relationship to Judaism and so forth. We urge you to tell your friends, we urge you to talk about the work we do. If people are interested in helping us, we appreciate any help we can get. In December, we're going to be running a full-day conference on the thought of Maimonides. We're going to have Professor Jim Diamond, Kenneth Green from Chicago, Kenneth Ziskin, and a couple of other people are going to be coming, and we're going to thoroughly investigate Maimonidean thought. In January, we're going to be running a conference on Jewish parenting, and we have planned for the spring two conferences, one specifically on mental health and Judaism and psychology, and as well, we're planning a very large conference on women and Judaism for the late spring in May of 2005, and please check our website for upcoming details. It's my pleasure now to introduce from Bar-Ilan, Dov Altman, who's the National Executive Director of Bar-Ilan University, to give greetings.
Thank you very much. On behalf of Bar-Ilan University, I thank you all for coming out tonight to hear one of our finest, one of our best. We're very excited at Bar-Ilan University. This year, we're coming up our 50th anniversary. So this is our Jubilee anniversary. Bar-Ilan, 50 years ago, was founded on the principle of mixing and merging and bringing together the study of Torah and science. And we were able to accomplish that by ensuring that the very heart of the university, the Jesselson Institute for Advanced Torah Studies, is really the prime focus of the university. All of our students at Bar-Ilan University, and right now we're Israel's largest, we have over 30,000 students at Bar-Ilan. Each and every student at Bar-Ilan is required to take 25% of their course load in Jewish studies. We're the only university in Israel that requires that. And somebody once said to me, if all the universities in Israel are for Jews, Bar-Ilan is the only Jewish university. Because at our core, at the very heart of who we are, is our Machon, is the Jesselson Institute for Advanced Studies, of which Dr. Sperber is the president. You know, we have right now at the Institute 1,200 students who not only are studying secular degrees, they're studying law, they're studying humanities, they're studying business, they're studying brain research, nanotechnology. But on top of their full degree, on top of their full studies, they spend, I think, 50 hours a week studying Torah, studying Talmud, studying who we are. And we're not only looking for those students, we've also, through the work of Dr. Sperber, we've opened up the Machon to all of our students at Bar-Ilan so that we can take all of Israel, all of our kids, whether they're coming from a Dati family, whether they're coming from a secular family, and we're giving them the opportunity to learn, to study, and to really enjoy who we are and what we're all about. So this is going to be a wonderful year for Bar-Ilan. We're planning some amazing activities both here in Canada and Israel. I urge all of you to come visit us on your next visit to Israel. You're always welcome. Our door is always welcome. The Machon's door is always open and welcome for you to join us. We're going to be planning a very large mission this June, and I urge all of you, please come. Please join us at Bar Ilan, and please come and see the beauty of what is Bar Ilan and the beauty of what is Israel. So thank you very much.
Today's lecture by Rabbi Dr. Sperber is being sponsored by the Krauss family in honor of the memory and yahrzeit of my father, Nota Krauss. I lost my father when I was 14, but I have made every effort to hold on to whatever memories I have of my father with a special clarity. It is as a result of those memories that our family has chosen to sponsor this lecture. My father was a very quiet man, not in the slightest interested in accolade or praise. He was an exceedingly decent, kind, and honest human being. He gave generously to whomever he knew was in need, never expecting to be repaid or recognized in any way. He was an out-of-the-box original thinker who managed to adapt quickly to extreme circumstances. His father died when he was 1 year old, and he lost his mother, his two brothers and his sister, his wife and child, and his entire extended family during the Holocaust. And yet, he orchestrated the saving of his wife's family during the Holocaust through his own ingenuity. He learned new skills as they were required, going from being a partner in a leather business when he was 15 to starting a chocolate factory after the war in Vienna and to becoming a successful builder in Toronto. My father would not have wanted me to talk about him like this or at all. He was an extremely humble man, but he would have been honored to be associated with a Talmud Chacham like Rabbi Dr. Sperber, an original, innovative thinker par excellence. Dr. Sperber holds a BA in History of Art and a PhD in Ancient History and Jewish Studies from London University. He studied at Yeshivat Kol Torah and the Hebron Yeshiva in Jerusalem. He recently became the president, a newly minted position, of the Institute of Advanced Torah Learning at Bar Ilan, where 900 men and 300 women are studying Jewish thought, Tanakh, along with Talmud. Dr. Sperber is an outstanding thinker, seeking to reintroduce innovative, progressive approaches to confront modernity with normative halacha, and to reintroduce the human condition in response back into the halachic approach to life. Please welcome Dr. Sperber.
Good evening to everyone. Firstly, I'd like to express my thanks and gratitude to Rabbi and Kelman and his wife for inviting me here, making this possible, and to all the partners, some of whom I know, some of whom I presume I don't know, who have made this event possible. What I'd like to talk about this evening is an issue which has an overall aspect, but we will touch upon it in a fairly narrow focus. The overall problem or issue is the basic tension that exists within the field of halakha between the conservative, with a small c, nature of halakha, the fact that it's a text-based system, and that it's based on texts that go back hundreds and even thousands of years, on the one hand, and the constant need for a system of this nature, in order for it to survive, to adapt itself to the changing demands of time. On the one hand, one is aware of the fact that certain things are immutable. They're engraved in stone, or perhaps they're written on parchment with a quill. And they're halachot, laws, which have an abiding significance. And which cannot be changed. On the other hand, we know that society is constantly changing, that our life now is totally different from the life of the Jews in the desert 3,500 years ago, for the life of the Jews in the Second Temple 2,000 years ago, from the life of the Jews in North Africa and Spain 1,000 years ago, from the life of the people who lived in Tzfat 500 years ago. Those are the key periods in which our codexes were penned and created. And those are the codexes in accordance of which we have to live our lives. The Torah, the Mishnah, the Gemara, the Rambam, the Shulchan Aruch, and so on and so forth. On the other hand, it's very clear to everybody that nobody in the present day lives in accordance with the rulings of the Shulchan Aruch, which is not ancient, 500 years ago. Because the situation has changed, and because electricity didn't exist in that time, and because there weren't cars, and because the whole of society was built in a totally different fashion. And in every period of Jewish history, the halakha was able to confront new situations, to appreciate the challenges that these new situations posed, and to find solutions which existed within the parameters of normative halachic thinking. Throughout Jewish history, we find radical innovations taking place, which were totally accepted by the whole of the rabbinic world. And when we think back and look at them, as it were, objectively, we are amazed at the degree of courage and the originality of and creativity of the thinking of these rabbis, who could solve problems in such a humanly acceptable fashion. The examples are legion. We know them. We know that Hillel innovated a puzbul, which almost erased a biblical law from the Chumash text. We know that in much later period of time, there was an introduction of something which is called the Heter Iska, which permitted the taking of usury from fellow Jews, which again is a biblically forbidden law. And so on and so forth. We don't have to bring so many examples because they're generally known. The techniques used were exceedingly sophisticated. But what was remarkable about these innovations was that they were accepted. And they were accepted to the extent that we are no longer aware of the fact that they were innovative. So everybody has a bank account in Israel, and we're dealing with Jews, and we're taking ribbit, we're receiving interest, or we're losing it, whichever way works. And Israel, during the sabbatical year, continues to market its produce despite all the difficulties. And we have an army which functions on Shabbat. And when we open our taps in Jerusalem on Shabbat, we realize that the water has been pumped up from the sources in the Shfela with electric pumps on Shabbat. And when we flush a toilet, we realize that the water probably is going eventually to irrigate some area many miles away. And we're totally unaware of the fact that these are very serious, difficult halachic problems that have been given solutions that we take for granted. That many of us take for granted. There are certain elements in our population that do not take them for granted, and that do not accept them, and that will not flush a toilet on Shabbat, and that will not use electricity on Shabbat, and that will not print their newspapers or their books on the paper that was produced by the Gedera paper mills, because they cannot close and they cannot stop their machinery over the weekend for technical reasons, and so on and so forth. So what I'm saying is that basically, if we look at the overall view of halakha from a historical perspective, it's very clear to us that the halakha always found a means to respond to the challenges of each generation. And they did so again within the parameters of normative halakhic thinking. In our own day, there have been many societal changes. Present-day society is quite different from the society of from before the Second World War, which was just 50, 60 years ago. The Holocaust brought about a caesura, a break in tradition, in Jewish society. It brought about a great deal of mobility, and it brought in its wake modernity to Judaism. Shtetlich no longer existed. They'd been wiped out. People moved into towns, lived in a completely different social setting. In the days before the Second World War, the great centers of Jewish learning in Poland, Galicia, in the West, perhaps in North Africa, in Baghdad and Aleppo in the East, the rabbi was an autonomous entity. He made his decisions for his own kehillah, and the means of communications had not been developed so that whatever he said was accepted by his people, and very few people outside his kehillah knew what was going on. He was, as it were, a master within his own small, circumscribed kingdom. There didn't exist, or there hardly existed, organizations, guilds, trade unions of rabbis, the RCA, etc., etc. The rabbi, in general, didn't fear what other people would say about him, because what other people didn't know what he was going to say or what he said. When there were difficult problems, he would ask for the approbation of other rabbis. Letters would be sent from one place to another, and they would retrieve a haskama for serious issues. I remember my grandfather, Alav HaShalom, who was a member of the Moitzat Gedolei HaTorah, one of the leading rabbis in Transylvania. After the Second World War, he and the Torah Rebbe, between them, solved all the aguna problems of Romania. And they got haskamot, approbations from other rabbis in Romania. It was a remarkable achievement. Hardly anybody knows about it. certain major societal changes have taken place in the Jewish society. One of them, and the one that I wish to focus upon on this evening, is the change in the status of women. Everybody knows the famous book, A Room of One's Own, written in the 19th century. Women in the 19th century, with the exception perhaps of Queen Victoria and one or two others, basically were relegated to a second place. In feudal terms, they were villeins, not villains. They were serfs. They were not independent entities. Nowadays, in Israel, we've had a woman prime minister, not just in India. We have women sitting on the Supreme Court. We had a woman's national ombudsman. We have quite a number of ministers who are women, and so on and so forth. So it's only understandable that in the Orthodox community, women who can serve as lawyers, as judges, as ministers, should seek to have a greater part in Jewish ritual activities, in Jewish halachic activities. Traditionally, if we look at the history of the status of women in Jewish law, they played very little roles. It's true that there were a certain Talmidot Chachamim, both in Talmudic period, in the biblical period, we had Dvorah HaNaviah. In the Talmudic period, we have Buria, we have Yalta. We know about the daughters of Rashi, who wrote some of his responsa. We know of medieval authors of Piyutim who were women. We know that there were women in the Eastern Oriental communities who were actually giving shiurim in a yeshiva behind a curtain. We know that they played a role, but these were very rare and scattered individuals. They certainly didn't constitute the mainstream within the Jewish society. Halachically, it would seem that there are all sorts of limitations upon the areas in which women can be actively involved. Nonetheless, over the past generation, less than 30 years, a major revolution has taken place within Orthodox Judaism, and it took place quietly, and it took place in a non-revolutionary fashion, in a non-confrontational fashion, and that's the incident of women studying Torah. It should be borne in mind that this revolution actually began within the Haredi world. At that time they weren't called Haredi, and that's Agudat Yisrael. Sarah Schneer, she introduced Torah learning into the Beit Yaakov system. And she got the Haskamah, the approbation of the Mishnah Berurah. And he argued that in present day, when women are taking a more active role in all areas of society, and where there was also a sort of a downward movement of religiosity, that's how he saw it. It was more important that women be trained and educated so that they could educate their children. So the Chofetz Chaim actually, in a sense, from what we would think is the Haredi sector was one of the key personalities who enabled the beginnings of Torah learning for women. But still, this was in a very limited framework, and it was mainly halachot and Torah, shebichdav, chumash, and God forfend that a woman should learn Gemara. As I said, over the last generation, 30 years ago, there were no frameworks for women to study Gemara. It wasn't studied in any of the schools, in any of the Mamlachti Dati schools. There were not yeshivot for women. This was started by a few brave individuals in Israel, and then afterwards, later, copied to a certain extent elsewhere in the United States and in other countries to a lesser extent. But now, in Israel alone, there are over 60 different institutions where thousands, literally thousands of young women, after they finish school or Shehut Lumi or perhaps even the army, study intensively all aspects of Jewish thought and learning. Mishnah, Gemara, Halakha, Jewish thought, Machshevet Israel. Nobody seems to be particularly disturbed by this. Even though we know the statement in the Gemara that Kol mi shemelamed bito Torah melamda tiflut, and I don't want to translate it. But it's become accepted. It was a gradual process. As it was mentioned, in Bar-Ilan we have hundreds and hundreds of young women that spend half of their learning day studying Torah, studying Gemara, studying Mishnah, studying Halakha. Nowadays in Israel you have Toanot Rabbaniot, women, not lawyers, what would we call them? Let's call them advocates, pleaders, who come before the rabbinic court. This is a remarkable revolution that the Moitzat HaRabbanut HaRashit was willing to permit women to come and plead on halachic grounds for women in the cases of divorce, etc. This was a ridiculous situation because at all times, a woman lawyer could always come and plead the gate. And she probably didn't have any halakhic training, so she couldn't really confront the dayanim, the rabbis, on their own grounds. This was a struggle. It wasn't an easy thing to get the rabbinate in Israel to accept the notion that women who are not lawyers, but who'd been trained and examined by the rabbinate, would be able to come into a court and plead their case. As you probably know, there are also women poskot. Now they're not rabbis, but they deal with specific questions of halachic nature. They're trained within these new frameworks of Torah learning, and they're accepted within certain sectors of our society. Many of them deal with womanly issues, and it's far more convenient for a woman to go to another woman to ask these types of questions, both for reasons of modesty and for reasons that there will be a greater understanding on the part of a woman when another woman asks her a question. Now, these events have taken place, as I said, in a sort of non-confrontational fashion. They've happened over a period of years, a relatively short period when we think in terms of legal development, because legal systems are usually rather inflexible. I want to give an example or two of the extent to which things have turned around completely, from being completely asur to to a positive mitzvah. The diametrically opposed situations. Approximately 100 years ago, there was a great rabbi who came from Eastern Europe and settled in the United States, called Rav Volkin. Rav Volkin wrote a sefer called Zakan Aaron, a very important book of responsa. And he was asked whether it was permissible, according to Jewish law, to make a kind of festivity for a young lady who reaches the age of 12. Bat mitzvah. Now, Volkin wrote as follows. Nira li sheyesh baze mishum isur d'oraita. It would appear to me that this is forbidden by biblical law. He goes on to say that one of the reasons that it's forbidden is because the Reform community does this. Ki harashaim, the shaim of the reforms, says in brackets, reformator, mishtamshim bahem. They do this. Can we do something shesanui umetu'av, which is hateful and disgusting? Koshkeim bedvarim shehim dvarim mitzad atzmam yesh bahem isur gadol. How much more so when the thing in itself is absolutely forbidden? As to say, there are two aspects to this. The thing in itself is absolutely forbidden. In addition to that, it looks like what the Reform people are doing, therefore, is absolutely disgusting and reprehensible. This was in the 1880s. The Ben Ish Chai, the leading posek in Baghdad, in the beginning of the 20th century, 30 years later, writes that in Baghdad we don't do this. It's not our custom. Nonetheless, even though we don't do it, if the family wants to make this a day of joy and festivity, I advise that she wear Bigdei Shabbat, Shabbos clothes, and if possible, she should wear Beged Chadash, Im Yesh La'el Yada, if she has enough money to buy one, or the family has, and then she should say Shechianu, bearing in mind that this is her 12th birthday, and she's nichneset le'ol mitzvot. She becomes duty-bound to carry out mitzvot. Of course, but she'll only do that if she wears a new clothes. And even though in our time and in our community it is not done to do so, nonetheless, those who will do so, yafe ya'asu. It's a positive move. So we've moved from something which is forbidden, absolutely reprehensible and disgusting, to wearing a new clothes, making a shechianu, even though it's not done in our community, and it's positive. This is a 30-year gap. The Moshe Feinstein in a tshuva writes, Chagigat v'simchat bat mitzvah, the festivities and the joy that take place in a bat mitzvah, En shum semech lachshivam kesudat mitzvah. There's no source that could, no literally legal source that could make this and give it the status of a sudat mitzvah. It's just kesimchat yom uledet ba'alma. It's just a birthday celebration. However, if the father wants to make this somewhat more significant, then he should say a Dvar Torah. If he says a Dvar Torah, then the festivities become more positive. So it has nothing to do with her. She has a birthday and he says a Dvar Torah. And then he says there's certainly a mitzvah if he makes a Dvar Torah. Rav Ovadia Yosef has a long tshuva, and of course when Rav Ovadia Yosef has a tshuva, he gives you all the sources, so I didn't have to be a baki to get to these things, because he's done all the work for us. And he says, following on the Ben Ish Chai, which incidentally he often disagrees with, he says, in my opinion, in the same way as a father at a bar mitzvah makes a bracha, baruch sheptarani mion shoshozeh, so too, at a bat mitzvah, the father should say, baruch sheptarani mion shoshozu. This is done in a synagogue, not at the house. He says that in such an occasion, you should have shirim v'tushpachot, ube ve'az behai gavna have sudat mitzvah. And then it becomes a sudat mitzvah. And then he gives the sources for this. Ubevadai kesheyesh dvar Torah v'shirot v'tushpachot l'Hashem have sudat mitzvah. Umikol shkein levat shigia le'mitzvot tahavu bichlal mitzvah gedola. He now says that if a girl comes of maturity and becomes duty bound to keep the mitzvot, to make such an event out of it is a mitzvah gedola. And this should be encouraged because even if the people that did it up to now were not aware of the halachic precedents or justifications for this, they are, as it were, Nevi'im. Ruach HaKodesh told them what they ought to do without their being aware of the fact. This is a standard halachic formulation. Earlier on than this, Rav Priel Weinberg and Sri Deyesh, one of the giants of the post-World War II halachists who lived his latter years in Switzerland, in Montreux, who suffered very severely during the Holocaust, writes as follows. Kol zesh katavti lebirura shel halacha zo. All the above that I've written with regard to the question of bat mitzvah, I've written in order to clarify the halachic precedents. Ulemaase adavar talui bekavanat harotzim לחדש מנהג זה של חגיגת הבת מצווה. Everything depends on the true intentions of those who wish to innovate a new custom of the festivities around the bat mitzvah. אם מתכוונים לשם מצווה, whether they really want to do this לשם שמיים, או חלילה לשם חיקוי המינים, or chaz v'chalila, just to copy the heretics, that is the reform. If it's just for some sort of a political end, if it's just because they want to be closer to the conservative and the reforms, then it's unacceptable. If it's really because they wish to introduce a new spiritual element into their life and into the life of their children, then it's a mitzvah gedolah. I'm not unaware of the fact that there are those who are God-fearing, those are the Haredim, Hayareim. Osrim u'machmirim, they say it's forbidden, and they're always machmirim. She'einam samim leiv b'she'elot shel minagim datiim l'shikulim hegyonim, who pay no attention in questions of minhag and halacha, religious issues, to logical arguments, ואף אינם נותנים דעתם לבירורים הלכתיים, and they take no account of halachic analysis, אלא דנים עליהם על פי רגשות הלב בלבד, but just their gut feelings. והלב היהודי, and the Jewish heart, הדבק במסורת הורים ומורים, which is so closely attuned and dependent upon the tradition of the fathers and the teachers, nirta mikol shinui shu b'minhag hadati, automatically is hesitant to make any change in religious customs. So this is the justification, which he understands. This is the natural tendency of the Haredim, of the Yireim. They're frightened, they fear. That's why he calls them Yireim. It has this double meaning over here. It's very subtle. They're frightened of making any innovative change. They see the danger in it. They don't take into account halachic precedents. They don't examine it from a logical point of view. Their heart fears change. Aleihem yesh lahamlitz ma shekatav haRambam. For them I would advise that they read what the Rambam wrote in the Perush HaMishnayot Legitin, Perek Chet, Mishnah Chet. There he rules against the established custom, which incidentally you all keep to even now, that she'ein lo makor, which has no source, according to the Rambam, that the Kohanim receive the first aliyah, whether they be learned or even if they're absolute Amei Haaretz. So the Rambam inveighs against an established custom, and there he discusses it. And he says, why? Well, Rav Weinberg says, look, you have to look at the sources, you have to see them, you have to understand it from a logical point of view, you have to take into account the social situation, you have to take into account the intentions of the people who are trying to bring about these changes, whether they're genuine, and do not be frightened, al tiyeh yarei, from making changes if they can be justified halachically. And of course, this only takes place la'achar shekatavti birura shel halacha zo, after I've examined and proven the halachic justification for such activities. I could give examples of earlier rabbis that had also taken this position, some of which were accepted, some of which were not accepted, but I wanted to give this as an example of something where there'd been a complete turnaround. From Rav Volkin writing in the 70s saying that it's davar metu'av, something reprehensible, davar sha'av.